This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. It was 1935 in a small Pennsylvania town when Mary Brooks met Luther Snyder. That meeting led to a correspondence by letter that lasted for nearly 4 years and is a book, Dear Mary, Dear Luther, A Courtship in Letters. It was written by their daughter, Connecticut author Jill Marie Snyder. Working on that collection of letters led Ms. Snyder to research her family history, and that work revealed a unique story of a black family's journey through American history. Jill Snyder joins me now on Zoom. Ms. Snyder, hello. Welcome to The Full Story.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
When were these letters written? What four-year period are we talking about?
They began in mid-1937 and lasted until the end of 1940.
And how many letters are there altogether?
I've never counted them. I'm guessing about 160, 170, around that.
Wow. And your mother saved all of these letters. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, they both saved their letters. And at some point, she organized them in, you know, his letter, hers letters. So when I found them, they were all in order.
That's really remarkable. When did you discover that these letters existed?
I knew they existed. My mother had mentioned them a few times through the years, but I found them after she passed away. They were in her nightstand next to her bed.
Wow.
And I didn't actually read them for a couple of years. And then I decided I needed to do something with them to preserve them after they'd kept them all those years. And step by step, it led to writing the book.
Now, I understand that your mother did want to publish them herself at some point, but that didn't happen. Why not?
She had a conversation. There's a Dr. Seltzer in New Haven you may have heard of, who was a physician, but he was also an author, and he was her physician. And so she broached the subject with him if he thought the letters would make an interesting book. And he kind of hemmed and hawed and didn't really give her an answer. But she relayed that conversation to me. I was a teenager at the time. I remembered that. And that's when I felt I had permission to read the letters.
Maybe we could go back to the beginning, so to speak. Could you share with us the story of how your parents met and how they started writing to each other, how they began this long journey of corresponding via the U.S. Post Office?
Sure. They met when they were paired in a wedding procession in, I think, probably about a year or more before the letters actually began. And my father learned that my mother lived next door to his aunt. So he would visit his aunt, which he rarely did before this little relationship began. He would go to visit his aunt and then pop over and spend long hours with my mother and her sister on their front porch. And for about a year, they didn't know which sister was the attraction. But on one occasion, Sarah wasn't there. Mary was alone. And apparently my father made it clear that Mary was his intended target.
And this was in Pennsylvania, yes?
Yes, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Mm. And how did the letter writing start? Since they were living so close to one another, why did they have to keep up a correspondence through letters?
Well, it was the 1930s. There was a depression. And so my father left Wilkes-Barre to find work. And he started with a summer working in Asbury Park, New Jersey, as a bellman and sort of a helper around the summer resort. And then at the end of the summer, he went to live in Harlem. And so the letters began as soon as he left. They started their correspondence.
And they're really, I mean, these letters are really wonderful. They're like snapshots with very descriptive captions, you know, details which kind of draw you into a moment in time. For example, we kind of singled out one here that is compelling. The song Boohoo is mentioned in some of their earlier letters. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Apparently, it was a very popular song in that time period. Guy Lombardo and his orchestra. And you can Google Boohoo and hear it. It's a cute song. Boohoo, you've got me crying for you. Mm. I won't try singing.
Boohoo, you've got me crying for you. And as I I sit here and sigh, say I can't believe it's true, boo-hoo.
It was a number one hit, I believe, at the time. And they often mentioned songs throughout the letters.
Yes, I was going to say that. They mentioned more than just Boohoo. There were several letters that brought up various songs and orchestras that were traveling through town and them going to the concerts and dances. What do you think about including that information there? What does that tell you about your parents?
Oh, I think on one level it was a way for them to communicate their feelings without being direct. They would share a song they heard that they really loved, and sometimes they'd say, it reminded me of you. In our home, there was music on playing more often than the television playing, so they both just really love music.
I was wondering if you might share one of the letters with us, perhaps read one for us, and it being a new year, maybe the letter from January 1st of 1939, 82 years ago, when your father's wishing your mother a happy new year.
1939, that January letter is one of my favorites, because up until then, the letters had been sort of friendly, certainly not romantic. They didn't reveal a lot about what they were feeling. But my father's January 1939 letter, he writes it after a night out of celebrating the new year. So he's a bit tipsy. and he says, "Dear Mary, happy new year, baby. It's now 9 a.m. New Year's Day, and I just come in from one of those wild New Year's nights, and the first and only one I could think about is you. And before I retire, I must express myself and let you know how I feel." And a little later in the letter, he says, "Yes, indeed, Mary, you really do things to me."
That gets right to a point, I guess, doesn't it? Did the tone of the letters track down that path afterwards? Is that sort of a turning point?
It is a turning point. They get a little more personal. They express their feelings more, and their relationship before that had been kind of a doldrums. But from this point on, it begins to progress, and they become closer.
I think you also mentioned that working on the book helped you see your parents through the eyes of an adult rather than a child. What did you mean by that?
As a child, we only see our parents through one dimension of their role as our parent. But through these letters, I saw them, a much broader view of them, and realized they had hopes and dreams like all young people do, but they weren't able to fulfill them. My mother wanted to be an artist. My father just wanted to go to college. I don't know if he had a goal beyond that, and they weren't able to do either of those things. So I saw them, I guess I felt grateful for them that they imbued in my brothers and I that we had potential and we could go to college and we could do whatever we wanted to do. And when I remember them talking to me that way, not thinking about their own disappointments and how their lives, they didn't have the life they had dreamed of when they were young.
What brought your parents to Connecticut?
They married in January 1941. And the factory here in New Haven, Winchester's, was gearing up for the war effort. Mm. And they heard through a family member, a distant cousin of my mother, that they were hiring here in New Haven. And my brother Roy was on the way. They'd been married about 6 months then. And I'm sure my father realized he needed to earn more to take care of his family. So they came to New Haven just like that, just like thousands of other Black families came to New Haven, most of them from the South, but, my family came from Pennsylvania.
Do you think the experience of your parents that you've discovered through these letters and through your other research into your family, which I'd like to ask you about in just a moment, do you think their experience reflects the experience of many other Black families in the country, not just coming to Connecticut to work at Winchester or other factories that were connected with the war effort, but just generally speaking?
I'd say generally, very generally, because there are, of course, obstacles to Black people achieving goals and aspiring to move up the socioeconomic ladder, if you will. So in, yes, in general terms, and also in encountering racism and acts of bigotry, obviously. The difference perhaps is that my family was in the North for several generations and were free people before the Emancipation Proclamation, before 1863. So we didn't have that experience of the worst aspects of enslavement, you know, working in the South and cotton fields and that kind of thing. But other than that, yes, in general, their experience is reflective of the experience of all Black families in this country, unfortunately.
How did your work on the book with these letters, how did that work lead you to research your family's genealogy, going even deeper into the past?
Well, the letters are light. They don't really discuss any of the problems that they're having or the challenges that the family has been through. Now, but I'm sure in their conversations when they're together, those things probably came up. So I wanted people to understand that although the letters are light and fun in some respects, that these were two people who had experienced a lot in their own lives and had in their broader family circle. Certainly there has been acts of bigotry that had some devastating consequences.
More of my conversation with Jill Snyder is coming up right after this quick break. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. And now let's get back to my conversation with Connecticut author Jill Snyder. You also share that your family history reveals both of your grandmothers lived lives that really stood out back in their day. Could you talk a little bit about that? How so?
Yes, both of my grandmothers were outcasts in their communities. My grandmother Stella, who was of Welsh and German descent, you know, married a Black man in 1917, and her family cut her off. She never spoke to her father again after that, or her brothers, and only saw her mother a few times in the remainder of her life. My father never knew his father. His mother was unwed when he was born. And of course, in the early 1900s and 1911, when that happened, she was just sort of not accepted by many people. And my father experienced a lot of taunts and bullying when he was young because of that fact that he was, you know, he didn't know his dad. So those histories, I don't know exactly how they play into their personalities and their relationships, but I felt like they had sort of that unspoken bond. They didn't have to explain a lot to each other about their families and their lives. There was a lot that they probably knew about each other just by living in the same community.
How did you feel after being able to, first of all, see these letters and then work on the book and discover quite a bit about your genealogy, about your family's history? What sort of a feeling did that bring to you?
It was very healing and joyful, especially discovering my ancestor, Henry Jones, who I found had escaped from enslavement in the 1820s. And being a person of African descent, of course, know that I have ancestors who were enslaved, but having a name, it brought me to tears. Mm. It was very emotional. But at the same time, it was very healing to discover him and find connections to other cousins, and found hundreds of new people that I'm related to. It was a joyful thing.
You've encouraged Black families to try to document their histories as well. Why is that important?
I think it's important, A, to have a much broader understanding of the Black experience in this country. When I was growing up, we heard a single story in school that Black people were enslaved in the South, and then some people came North, and there, you know, there wasn't much more to it. You know, there was a war fought to free the slaves. but you know, we weren't really presented in our full humanity. We're just sort of stick figures in history. So to illuminate the lives of the people who came before us, I think it is really important for historians to know, and it's important for future generations to know. They may have been enslaved, they may have experienced oppressive racism, but they were full human beings who had lives, had emotions, dreams, cares. As I said, it's joyful to realize that the sacrifices that were made for us to have a better life today, you know, in African culture, it's important to revere ancestors, and ancestors are not revered simply because they lived and died. They're revered for what they did in their life to make our lives better today. So I love my ancestor, Henry Jones, who dared to escape enslavement, went north to Pennsylvania, married and made a family. I just think that's marvelous that after what he'd been through, and perhaps what his mother and his foremothers had been through, that he was still able to love and be loved. And what a statement that is about, you know, the ability of human beings to recover from trauma, pain. So that's why I think it's inspiring. It certainly has inspired me.
It seems certainly fortunate that you were able to find as much information as you did about your family's history. I wonder how many families run into problems finding documentation or any kind of information about their lineage.
It is difficult, absolutely. As I said, I had an advantage because my family had been in the North, so there are records, census records, and other records that I could mine. 1863 is a wall, trying to find people before that. But many people do. If people know where an ancestor lived, especially where they died, often there are records for in the 1800s about people who were enslaved during their life but died after freedom. That's a place to start, to be able to go backwards. Many enslaved people took the name of their slaveholder when they were freed. So that might help to be a clue. So there, it's not impossible. It's certainly difficult, but it's not impossible.
Another question about letters. It seems most people don't sit down to write letters anymore. Do you think that digital correspondence, social media platforms, do they offer the same sort of raw material for future generations to learn about their family histories?
I don't think so. Taking time to write a complete letter is a lot different than dashing off text messages or tweets. Mm. It was a wonderful discipline that people had to write each other letters. And my parents' letters are almost, I feel for them at times, perhaps even therapeutic. They take time at the end of the day, collect one's thoughts. They're almost like back and forth diaries. So I think that therapeutic value of writing a letter is missing from doing social media posts.
Well, I must say that looking at the letters the way you've got them laid out in the book, it's certainly, not to be superficial, but it's a page turner. You just
you want to see
what the response was to the previous letter. You know, it follows a certain path that's really, really fascinating.
Thank you.
I did want to ask you one more question. I understand you serve on the board of the Community Healing Network, which has a very specific mission. Could you tell us about that mission?
Sure. The mission of, I'll use CHN for short, is to help people heal from racism and the legacy of enslavement. We have a program we call Emotional Emancipation Circles, where people come together, learn about the history of racism, and learn about techniques to heal, and have a chance to tell stories, because we all have stories about bigotry that we've encountered and the way racism has affected our families. And so it's a safe place. And I've sat through many circles and watched people transform before my eyes when they have a chance to speak their truth. it's really been an important part of my life's work to be involved in that organization.
And is there a way people can find more information about the Community Healing Network?
Yes, we have a website, communityhealingnet.org. People can go there, and there's lots of information.
Ms. Snyder, thanks so much for talking with us about your family's history. It's been fascinating.
Well, I appreciate this very much. Thank you.
The book is Dear Mary, Dear Luther, and the author is Jill Snyder. She'll speak more about her parents and their letters at a virtual event organized by the New Haven Museum. That's this Wednesday, February 10th at 6 p.m. The Zoom lecture is full, but the museum will stream the lecture on their Facebook page. We have a link on our website to do that. It's at wshu.org. There's an old house, a very important house, in Huntington on Long Island that's, well, falling apart. One side has collapsed completely. Part of the roof has caved in, and the fallen wooden beams and siding are crumbling to dust. But even in this state of severe disrepair, this building is precious. It's known as the Crippen House, and it's a significant part of African-American history on Long Island. Peter Crippen, an African-American who was born a free person on a plantation in Virginia, bought it back in 1864. Right now, a coalition of groups are working to preserve this history. And joining me now on Zoom is Huntington Town historian Robert Hughes. Mr. Hughes, welcome, and thanks for taking time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. First of all, who was Peter Crippen? Could you tell us more about him?
Well, Peter Crippen was, as you said, a man born in Virginia on a plantation as a free man. It was not an easy time to be a free Black person in Virginia. So in the 1830s, he came up to Huntington and had a variety of jobs, originally at the brickyards, and then worked as a day laborer in various jobs throughout town, but was successful enough and saved up enough money to be able to buy property, as you said, in 1864. And at the time, he was one of only three African-Americans in the town of Huntington who owned property. So he was significant in that regard. He was also active in the local African-American community and was one of the founders of Bethel AME Church, which is the first African-American church in the town of Huntington.
Do we know just how he made his way to Long Island, and why was Long Island a destination?
Well, the owner of the brickyard, who was named Crossman, actually went down to Virginia to recruit workers, both white and Black people, to work up in the brickyards. It was really a thriving industry in Huntington in the 19th century. They produced millions and millions of bricks every year, and they needed labor. And Virginia seemed like a good place to go and find some people. How he actually got up here, whether by boat or wagon or other means, we don't know. But one way or another, he did find his way up to Long Island, I would assume probably by boat.
Do we know much about his experiences once he got to Long Island, what life was like for him here? You mentioned he saved enough to buy the house that we'll be talking about, but do we know much about his life working in the brickyard and family life here on Long Island?
We don't know a whole lot about his day-to-day existence, and we're trying to put more of that together. Some of his family members are still on Long Island. I think it's his great-great-grandson lives here, and his great-great-granddaughter lives in New Jersey. So we're trying to do some oral history with them to see if they can shed more light on his experiences. But, you know, this far removed, that may be difficult to do. One interesting tidbit, we know that he was a witness in a murder trial back in the 1850s.
Really? What do we know about that particular case?
You know, I have to reread the newspaper accounts. It's been a while, but I don't think it's going to tell much about his experience, but he was a witness to that case. And I'm sorry, I can't tell you right now because it's been a while since I've read it.
So as we mentioned, he was able to save enough to purchase the property that has become known today as the Peter Crippen House. Tell me more about the building itself. Was it an older building when he bought it? What do we know about the actual building and the property that it's on?
Our preliminary analysis of the smaller wing of the house, there are two wings. The wing to the right-hand side is a story and a half, and that appears to date to the 1650s.
Oh.
And we believe it was the first mill building in the town of Huntington. A mill had been established in 1658 and was decommissioned in 1672 when a new mill was built in another hamlet in the town of Huntington. And the old building was then moved up to its current location and converted to a residence. So by the time Peter Crippen purchased it in 1864, it was 200 years old and was a modest dwelling. So it was a small piece of property with a small house. And after he died, his children built the larger wing, which is now the part that is in very poor condition.
Did the house ever have a historic designation?
It had been designated as a local landmark by the Huntington Town Board in 2006, but they lifted that designation about 10 years later because the house had fallen into such disrepair and the owner was not in a position to do anything to repair it. But the town recently acquired the house at the end of 2019 for use as a parking lot for the sewage treatment plant, which is right next door to the house. And in that regard, now there was some resources behind an effort to try to do something with the house to preserve it in some fashion. We applied to the New York State Historic Preservation Office for a determination of whether the house would be eligible for listing on the National Register. And last November, the state said that it would be. As both a colonial industrial building, the mill building, and also as for its significance in ethnic history, particularly Black history.
It's a shame that it was allowed to, or for whatever reason, disintegrated into its current condition.
It is. And it's, you know, through no fault of anyone in particular, I think the resources to do something to try to shore it up and preserve it better were not there. The only deed for this property was the deed from 1864. So through the generations, the house got passed down from one family member to the next. So clear legal title to the house 170 years later was unclear. And that's why it took so long to close a transaction where the town wanted to purchase the property. And in that time, while waiting for that legal issue to be cleared up, the house just suffered. Which is unfortunate, but through no fault of anyone in particular.
I wondered if there was any particular difficulty in securing its designation or renewing its designation, because we're talking about African-American history here as opposed to the history of some other group.
You know, at one point that might have been the case, but I think in the current environment, there's a much more appreciation for the importance of preserving African-American sites because they have been overlooked for so long. The fact that it's an African-American site is really what helped us get the determination that it was eligible for the National Register. Without that, it might have been a much closer case, especially considering the condition of the building. But the fact that it's an important African-American site is what saved it.
I understand that there's currently an archaeological dig underway on the property, a study of the site?
Yes. One of the things we wanted to do before any action was taken on the property was to see what archaeological remains there might be. And somebody who in the community had heard about plans to demolish the house stepped forward, and he offered to donate the funds for the archaeology. It's Dr. Maines of the Maines Peace Prize Foundation. He donated $8,500. Which is paying for a phase one archaeology study. The archaeologist did her field work over the last couple of weeks and is now analyzing what she found and writing up a report and may recommend further study. We'll have to see when we get the report what she's recommending.
Okay, it's time now to take a quick break. We'll continue talking with Robert Hughes in just a minute. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. We're back now with more of my interview with Town of Huntington historian Robert Hughes. So phase one, how thorough is that archaeological dig when it comes to, say, a complete study of a site? And I assume you mean she's looking at the information that she was able to find and determine whether or not the site warrants even further archaeological investigation.
Yes, yes. Phase one involves digging test pits. In this case, they were spaced about every 25 feet. There were 12 test pits on the property. As I said, it's not a very large piece of property. And she would dig down 1 to 2 feet, depending on what she was finding, trying to find the historic ground cover level and see what artifacts there were. And she found some pieces of ceramics, plates, a glass Vaseline jar from, looks like, the early 20th century. So she found enough, it seems, to recommend that larger holes be dug to see what else we can find.
As the town historian for Huntington, Mr. Hughes, and I should remind people we're talking to Robert Hughes, the town historian for Huntington on Long Island. How does this property, how does the history involving Peter Crippen fit into the larger history of Huntington itself?
It's one more piece of the fabric of the town's history. I think a lot of people don't appreciate the long history, the long African-American history in the town of Huntington. The first African-Americans lived in Huntington dating back to the 17th century. And of course, they were enslaved, and there were about 200 or 300 enslaved people at the time of the American Revolution in Huntington. There was gradual manumission through the early 19th century. And Peter Crippen represents sort of the next phase in the town's African-American history, where a lot of workers came up from Virginia to settle in Huntington, work in the brickyards, in the shipyards, and different industries that we had. And they are the ones who established, as I said, the first African-American church in town, which still exists, and predated the Great Migration that everyone thinks of in the early 20th century. Are part of that whole continuing history of African Americans in the town of Huntington.
Is there much evidence, hard evidence, like what you've found for the Crippen family so far, and going back further from the enslaved people prior to Mr. Crippen coming up? Is there much hard evidence of their existence here, other than what's been, you know, written down with pen and paper?
That's the very frustrating thing. When you're trying to research that history, you're limited to a few scattered legal documents here and there, census records, manumission papers, some court records, but nothing physical and tangible. I shouldn't say nothing, but very little physical and tangible survives, certainly not in the built environment. And that's what makes something like the Peter Crippen House so important. We did have... the first published African-American poet lived in the town of Huntington, Jupiter Hammond. He lived on Lloyd Neck, and we have his writings that were published in Connecticut in the 1760s. The house that he lived in, but it wasn't his house, it was his enslaver's house, that still survives. And the house where he lived in his old age, which is nearby the Crippen House, that survives. But other than these two houses, there's very little going back that far in the town's African-American history.
Best case, what is the goal for the property, for the house and the land? What would advocates supporting its preservation like to see done?
Well, this is a project that's been adopted by the town's African-American Historic Designation Council, and they would very much like to see a restored Crippen House become part of an African-American museum in the town of Huntington. The site where the house is located now is right next to the sewage treatment plant. And there's a whole story about why they put a sewage treatment plant next to where people were living. But of course, those people were in a minority community. And it's a mushy site near the head of the harbor, so the house has been sinking. So what we'd like to do is move the house, this is the oldest section of the house, to a drier location away from the sewage treatment plant, have it restored, and then become part of a larger African-American museum, which would be in a separate building, and create sort of a park-like setting for the two buildings that would really celebrate and let people know that there is a rich African-American history in this town of Huntington, and it would be a way for us to explore that history and discover more of it.
A somewhat technical question, given the condition, the current condition of the house, how would it be moved? Is that like disassembling it piece by piece and then reassembling it, or lifting it and moving it that way? How would that be accomplished?
That is something we have to determine, and the town has just received a grant from the Preservation League of New York State to fund a consultant, an engineer, to come in and do exactly that study that will determine how this can be moved, if it can be moved, and whether that would be in one piece, or does it have to be disassembled timber by timber and then reassembled on another site. I think I would hope that it can be moved in one piece, but I just don't know if that's possible, and that's why we're going to have the study done.
Is this a sort of project that's also funded through public contributions, or is it strictly a grant-oriented type of a project? How does the funding come to be with this kind of a project?
Well, so far, the archaeology has been funded by a private donation. The next study is going to be funded mostly by a grant and also by town funds. And as we move forward, and we do want to have the house restored, that's going to take a larger amount of money, and we probably will need to do some fundraising. There's a local not-for-profit in town called the 1653 Foundation, which has indicated that it will support this project and the reconstruction of the house. So we hope people will be able to donate through the foundation to support the project. And, you know, we'll seek funding from a variety of sources.
And just one more question, not necessarily directly related, but I'm wondering, given the pandemic, which seems to have affected just about everything, every project that's underway, have you experienced delays or any changes in plans due to the coronavirus?
You know, I don't think that it has really slowed us down, because so far the work that has been done has been outside work. The archaeology has been outside applying for the grant. We were able to do it on the grant schedule, on the cycle. We you know, it's that causes more of a delay because it's only two cycles per year. So you have to wait sometimes 6 months before you can put in an application. But, you know, we're moving right along. And if that has not slowed us down more than just your typical funding delays, which cause problems.
Is there any sort of a rough timeline, like when you hope to, again, best case, have a museum opened for public viewing?
That's hard to say, because that's a much bigger fundraising project to build a museum building and get it running. That's, you're probably talking 5 to 10 years down the road. Mm-hmm. But getting the Crippen House, which is 18 feet by 18 feet, restored on a new location, I'm hoping we can be done in a year or two. And most of the delay will be securing funding and permits and things like that. The actual work itself should not take that long. But, you know, knowing how things go, especially when you're dealing with the municipal government, 2 years is probably a realistic time frame.
Mr. Hughes, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Robert Hughes is the Huntington Town historian. We've been talking about the Peter Crippen House in Huntington on Long Island. For more about the work underway to preserve the Crippen House and the history it represents, we turn to Irene Moore. Ms. Moore is chairwoman of the African American Historic Designation Council, and she joins us by phone. Ms. Moore, hello, and welcome to The Full Story.
Good afternoon.
Could you first tell us, how did the African American Historic Designation Council come to be, and what is its mission?
The African American Council was established in 2005 by the town of Huntington, and its mandate is to research, discover, and document African Americans in the town of Huntington.
Was it a difficult task to get it established and to get some support for it?
Not really. The town of Huntington, our supervisor and the council people are very supportive of the African American Historic Designation Council. As a matter of fact, each council person appoint one member to the council.
And since we're focusing on the Crippen House in Huntington, could you tell me the role that the council is playing in the effort to preserve the Crippen House?
Well, since we serve under the umbrella of the town, we have been asked to head the efforts to preserve the Crippen House. And as part of that effort, we have a community group that we meet with. And we're also working directly with the town to preserve the Crippen House.
Now, I understand, too, that the Crippen House isn't the only very important site when it comes to African-American history on Long Island. And really, that's a major part, of course, of American history. Could you tell me a bit more about some of the other homes, the other buildings that are part of the town of Huntington? I understand that Booker T. Washington and John Coltrane once lived in the community.
Well, Booker T. Washington, he's the founder of, at that time it was called Tuskegee Institute, yes. But now it's Tuskegee University. And he had a summer home in the town of Huntington. It was located in Fort Salonger. So during the summers, he would spend his summers here with his family. And during that time, he was very active in the Huntington community. He taught Sunday school at the Bethel AME Church. And as you know, Bethel is one of the oldest African-American churches in the town of Huntington. And he also did fundraising for the trade school. And the trade school is one of the first schools in the town of Huntington. And John Coltrane has a family, had a house in Dix Hills. And he lived here and later moved to California. Another important person that's important to us was Juba Hammond. And Juba Hammond was enslaved on the Joseph Lord Manor, at the Joseph Lord Manor in Lord Harbor. He was the first African-American published poet in the country, actually. And prior to his death, he lived in the Huntington Village with his nephew, and that was down the street from where the Peter Crippen was house was located.
And is that house, is that home preserved as a historic site?
Yes, it is, and it has a historic marker at the site.
Is it difficult to get a site declared as historic? Does it take a lot of work to prove that it's a part of history that needs to be recognized nationally like this?
Actually, it's not that difficult if you have the support of the community. And with all the endeavors that we've been involved in, we've had community support.
I'd also like to ask you about the museum that the council's involved with, attempting to establish an African-American museum in Huntington. Can you tell me something about the goal and the timeline and what you hope to bring to that museum?
The council mission is to create an African-American museum in the town of Huntington to recognize and commemorate the contributions of African-Americans in the town and beyond. We would also like to recognize the contributions of the Crippen family and what they have done for the town during the Crippen year. In addition to highlighting the Crippen contributions, the museum would also serve the residents of the town as a learning center and highlighting the contributions of African-Americans in the town and beyond, and also house artifacts, sponsor cultural activities, workshops, and forums to enlighten the Huntington residents about the contributions of African-Americans in the town.
I'm speaking with Irene Moore, the chairwoman of the African-American Historic Designation Council in Huntington on Long Island. Ms. Moore, how long have you been involved with the council? Has it been since it was established?
Yes, I was involved since it was established. As a matter of fact, I was one of the original members.
And what moved you to become involved and to essentially help co-found this organization?
Prior to becoming part of the council, I guess I was working on my family history, and I realized that there were other African Americans that needed to be discovered and recognized. So I became part of the council, and that allowed me to not only learn more about how to research my family history, but also to research other African Americans that deserve to be preserved and recognized in the town of Huntington.
I would imagine that since that became known and since you got involved with the council, that you've heard from a number of people who are looking for help researching their family histories. I know that's not uncommon for that to happen.
We have been able to recommend to the residents of Huntington how they can go about researching their own families. And also the residents of Huntington has been helpful to us in bringing to our attention other African Americans in the town that needs to be recognized.
If a listener wants to know more about the council, about the African American Historic Designation Council, or to get more information perhaps about researching family history, is there a way for them to get in touch with the council?
We actually work through the town, and they can easily get in touch with the town historian, Robert Hughes, and he will put them in touch with us. But we also publish booklets about the residents in Huntington, and we have our booklets on the town's website. So if residents want to know more about African Americans in the town or the work we do, they can go on the town website, and our booklets are on the town website.
I would imagine that the site would be helpful for really anyone looking for more information about researching and discovering African American history.
We also work with the schools in the town of Huntington, and every 2 years we sponsor a essay poetry contest. So that allows us to share information with the school students about the work that we do. Our booklets are also available in the library, all of the libraries in the town, as well as the schools.
Ms. Moore, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and letting us know what's on the table when it comes to the museum.
Thank you for having me.
Irene Moore is the chairwoman of the African American Historic Designation Council in Huntington on Long Island. Tell us your family history story. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. And that's our show for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.